Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
What does it take to really become a successful artist? And what does it cost along the way? In this powerful episode of This Week in America, I talk with acclaimed sculptor, painter, and author, Arthur Norby, whose remarkable career spans over five decades in the arts. From humble beginnings in a tar paper shack in rural Minnesota to becoming a nationally recognized artist and creator of major public sculptures, Norby's journey is anything but ordinary. In his autobiography, The Artist You Never Knew, Norby opens up like never before, sharing the failure, sacrifices, risk, and defining moments that shaped his life. This is more than an artist's story. It's a raw, honest look at what it takes to chase a dream and never look back. We welcome to This Week in America, accomplished sculptor, painter, and author and artist, Arthur Norby. Arthur, welcome to the program. It is a pleasure to have you with us today.
Good morning, Rick. I'm happy to be here. It's a pleasure to do something like this on a beautiful Arizona morning.
Well, in Florida, it's not bad either. So this we've got that in common today. You're just 3 hours behind us out there, and it's a pleasure to have you here. So much to talk about. I love the career. I love the ups and the downs. At age 38, you decide you're going to shift gears. We'll talk about that as we go through the conversation. You've written 9 mystery books. Number 10 is on the way. What inspired you to write this book, the autobiography?
Oh, you know, As you know, and the audience doesn't know at this point, I've had a long career, and it's been local more than national. I'm not sure that's the right way to say that, but there are so many good artists that we're competing with every day, and then we disappear. A number of years ago, I made a comment about how little respect we give to artists after their death or during their life even, and I made this point. When a buyer, a collector, acquires a piece of art, they know who the artist is, they know his name, they may shake his hand, and it goes home, it goes on the wall or on a table. When that collector dies, it goes to a son or a daughter, usually. And when a visitor to the house says, so what's the story on this painting? That person will say, well, my father or my mother knew the artist and bought it from him or her in whatever year it was, and everybody is fine. But then when that person dies and we have a grandchild that comes into the picture and a visitor comes to her home and says, that's an interesting painting. Where did you get it? What, you know, the answer is, I think my grandma bought it from some guy in Tillamook. And then the next thing you know,
yes.
If in most cases it will go to a thrift store or to go to a closet, and people forget who the artist is. It has always bothered me that we don't remember artists, and I wanted this autobiography specifically for my family, and you've read it, so you know that it's very personal, and I wanted it for my collectors, and I have, I suppose, 1,000 people that have collected my work over the year. But that was my audience. It was for the people who might remember my name but wouldn't remember why they remembered it.
Well, I tell you, it's something else that's good. A good market is people like you aspiring early on in your career, deciding whether you could be an artist, make it pay the bills, or not. You walk us all the way through that. Let's talk about some of the defining moments. Let's start in 1976, when you basically are torn between doing the business and wanting to get into art. You gave yourself a 1-year sort of ultimatum that either do the art or forget about it. Talk about 1976. And that was life-changing for you.
Well, 1976 actually started back in 1967. When my Navy career looked like, well, my Navy career literally came to an end. The job for which I'd been trained and the jobs which I had been done had been abolished. That was the phrase they used, abolished, and were no longer available to me. And I was going to have to make major changes in a new career. So I left active service. I've joined a Naval Reserve and an intelligence group where I spent 10 years. But from 1967 to 1976, I had I'd say nine various failures, although my children said, Dad, they weren't failures. You just weren't successful in doing that. But I was trying to find a way to be successful. I had, limited skills. I was an artist. I was a draftsman and an illustrator, and I had done some things like that. But in 1975, I had the worst job I ever could have imagined, and I worked like crazy just to get it. But the first day on the job, I hated it. And in 1976, I felt such a failure that I called my children together and I said, guys, this is where it is. My marriage is going to hell. Their mother and I were not doing well. And I said, I need 1 year as an artist. I am not going to drive a bus. I'm not going to sweep floors. I will make whatever kind of art I have to make. And if I can't earn a living in a year, I'll put it behind me and get a job and never bring it up. Well, nobody in their right mind does that. But as I went into that first year, I did something that I guess I would encourage people to a limited degree. I burned every bridge I crossed. There was never going to be any going back. I was going to be an artist or died trying. And so 1 year led to 3 years. And at the end of 3 years, my wife and I divorced, and I continued. And I've been making art of one kind or another ever since.
It's so amazing.
And you hear this story more than once, somebody who is a complete failure, somebody who has lost everything, and they go through this door into the world of art, maybe a musician or a writer or whatever it is. And then they have found their motivation. They found the reason for being. And that's where I was. I've never questioned that decision in spite of all of the problems it brought to my family.
Well, ups and downs after that as well. This is 1976. In 1979, another defining moment, you decide to climb a mountain in California and sort your life out. Everybody should do that at least once in their lifetime, whether you're afraid of heights or not. Why did you climb the mountain? And you describe that as a turning point in your life as well. What happened then?
Well, that's kind of metaphorically, by the way. And it was when my divorce was final in the spring of 1979. And I found myself a week later or 2 weeks later, I was sitting on the mountain, as I call it. And the official paperwork for the divorce came through, and I looked at it and I said, man, you really screwed this up, Norby. You need to reverse your path, and you need to do something to get back on track, or you are going to die here on the mountain. That was basically it. But it was the climbing the mountain was more metaphorical than anything.
And that was a turning point. You got your life together. You were struggling as an artist. You talk about thriving in every way, but financially. And along came 1996 and an opportunity that again was a defining moment. Talk about that, because your work of art is still making an impression on people.
Well, in the 1980s, I did what every aspiring artist probably does. That is, I did a lot of weekend art shows, and I traveled a lot. 1978, I drove 77,000 miles and exhibited in 40 weeks out of 52, and that in itself is crazy. But in 1996, by that time I had remarried. I was living in Afton, Minnesota, and I responded to a call for artist credentials. The state of Minnesota was going to commission a large public sculpture to honor the Korean War veterans. And so I applied to that, and it turned out I was one of the seven finalists. I watched as the review committee decided which sculpture idea that should be in. And the design that I and landscape artist Robert Koss put together was chosen. And that was a two-year project, 27 months, actually. And I laugh when I tell people it was a 27-month project, but 13 months of it was paperwork for the state of Minnesota. But it was the project that gave me some national recognition so that when I moved to Arizona, I had some credibility. And when I traveled, I had a sculpture project in New Jersey and enough, a number of things like that. But 1996 was the turning point. And in fact, that was the biggest public project I ever did.
And that's on display at the state capitol in Minneapolis, in St. Paul.
St. Paul, yeah.
And that was a start of a career, over 700 sculptures later. Along the way, you've done so many that are interesting. The stainless steel sculpture depicting the Dove of Peace. Talk about that. That sounds so impressive. I've never seen it, but that sounds impressive, just describing it.
Well, it's so unique, Rick. My wife, Catherine, and I were living in New London, Minnesota, and I had a knock on the door. A man about my age came, and he said, hi, I'm Vernon. And my wife and I were by here last year. You weren't home when we all saw the sculpture in your yard. And we are looking for a sculptor to create a public piece to go to the International Peace Garden. Now, most people have not heard of the International Peace Garden. It is a huge and wonderful arboretum, if you will, a garden on the Canadian border in North Dakota. And so Vern belonged to a travel club, like a mobile home club, and they raised money to do this. And what we wanted was something that was uplifting and unique, and it was to go in the middle of a fountain. Well, I have always liked making sculptures of hands, and I've done lots and lots of them, put it that way. And so I came up with a design of a pair of hands releasing a dove into the air. Now, yes. The photos of that, don't show it, don't give it justice because photos are two-dimensional, but the piece has a six-foot wingspan, so it's a pretty good-sized piece of art. But that was the motivation.
That's amazing, the career that Arthur Norby has had. I want to talk about his book. His book is available wherever books are sold. The book is by Arthur Norby. His website, by the way, is norbygallery.com. You go there, you'll find information on so much. And we'll talk about that because if you're interested in artwork, buying something, talking to Arthur about consulting or whatever, all that information's on his website. The book is The Artist You Never Knew. It's available wherever books are sold. The link on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Another point in your life, and I'll call it a turning point. It's something we all probably run into. You are so busy with sculptures. You said it started to feel like a job, and you took 3 months off, and you went and did something you've always enjoyed, which is painting the clouds. Talk about that and the fact that taking a break, and did that reinvigorate your career at that point?
You know, I have a friend who says, you're so busy, how do you get all these things done? And my wife, Catherine, always smiled, and she said, well, I'm not sure what's going on, but when somebody asked him if he can do something, he said yes, and sure as heck, he's able to do it. But I've been fascinated by clouds since I was 10 years old. I did my first cloud rendering, not a painting, standing on the street in Montevideo, watching the sunset, and I was working on some colored construction paper and blackboard chalk. And you can imagine, so I would have been 10 or 11 years old, somewhere in there. It wasn't very good, but it was the clouds and the drama and the power that I saw there. I didn't see faces in the cloud like a lot of people do. But as I was in the Navy and as I traveled and I watched the clouds and the sunsets, and I got into my sculpture career, and I reached a point where I had 9 larger than life sculpture projects in my studio that all had deadlines, and I was happy. I mean, I wasn't complaining. I just loved, you know, that hard work because I was creating something that no one else had done. And so I turned to Catherine and I said, you know, when I get these pieces into the foundry, I'm going to take 3 months off and I'm just going to paint. And she said, what are you going to paint? I said, well, I don't know a lot of other things, but I said, I just love clouds. So I'm going to paint clouds. And so I have been painting clouds seriously since about 1999. I've done other things before that, but it was a chance for me to break away from the labor, if you will, of creating a sculpture and do something that it was strictly ethereal. My brain would go there, and
yes,
and I think I told you that when I write my novels, I don't use an outline. It's the same with my paintings, and people say, well, will you do this, will you do that? And I said, I'll make you a painting, and it'll be in this style, but I don't know when I touch the canvas the first time what that painting is actually going to look like. I'm guessing it will be about clouds, but the idea is to create something. I'm excited for the whole time because I don't know what happens with the next stroke of the brush, just like I don't know with the next keyboard stroke what I'm going to get out of it.
There's so much there that you touched on. Let's go back to the painting and the fact that you're not real sure when you get started. Does a painting take on a life of its own? I mean, you may think you're going somewhere. You lift your hand to do, you know, to put a stroke on there, and it goes another way. Does it take on a life of its own?
It does. And for any artists that are happen to be watching, any painters, I paint with oils and I do some glazing, and you'll know what that is. But I also mix my paints on the canvas. I'll dip the brush into my palette and pick up two or three or four colors, and I'll scrub it onto the canvas and see what's there, what is left behind when I pull the brush back. And that will tell me if I'm looking at a good place for a shadow or a good place for a highlight. And probably it's realistic to say that my paintings are five or six paintings deep, because sometimes that's what it takes.
When you have, and this is something I think can apply to everybody, when you hit that point where it's becoming a job, it's becoming a work, it's becoming really difficult to go in and work, do you recommend taking a little time like that and just getting away, rejigging, and come back and tackling the job at that point?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is if a person were to look at the collection of my art over the last 50 years, you'd find that every two or three years, something new showed up, or something old had disappeared. And I discovered that when I'm working on a painting or a sculpture and it doesn't have a strong personality, if it looks a lot like the last painting, then it's time to move on. And so in my sculpture career, you know, I've done everything from very traditional to Western, to whimsical, to abstract work. And so when I get bored a little bit, then I throw something else in there. And that has always led me to something new. And that's how I managed to go from being a strong sculptor to being a reasonable writer.
Our guest is Arthur Norby, N-O-R-B-Y. His website is norbygallery.com. That's important because you'll see a sample of all of his work there. Be able to get in contact with him as well. A link on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Books available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. Switch to books for a second. It's interesting you don't use an outline. Do you ever get to the point where that comes back to bite you a little bit, where you're suddenly going, yeah, I'm sure the people reading this are wondering what's going to happen next, and, well, I am too. Do you ever get to the point where you're in a corner book, and you got to figure out what to do?
Every book is like that. Every book is like that. And sometimes I have to walk away from the book for several days in order to straighten out what's in, you know, what is wrong. But, Rick, they're murder mysteries. They're historical mysteries. And if I had an outline, it would then be an academic project where I would be following that line. I like the fact that I most likely don't know what's going to be on the next page. So I'll be working on a chapter and I'll get in the middle of it and say, so where is this going? And then I stop and think, my characters, my geography, my history, coming out of my own experiences. So if I don't know what the villain is going to do, then I will sit back and think about, if that were me and I were in Montevideo, or if I were standing by Lacoparo Lake, what would I be thinking? Or what would my response be? And when I do that, then I come up with an idea. And it might take a half a dozen questions that I just put into the computer, and then I look at the questions and say, oh, of course, if that were me, that's what I would do.
This started with The Deadly Winter. That was the foundation for the Tom Hall mystery series. How did you come up with this concept of the mystery series? And did it start with The Deadly Winter? Was that going to be a series, or was that a one-off, and suddenly you realize there's a lot here?
Well, it was, if you look at the record, you'd know that it was intended to be a one-off. I wrote it in 1989. It went into a three-ring binder where it stayed until 2015. and I decided I was getting pretty old. If I was ever going to publish it, that was the time to do it. But that story was based on a story my father told about something that happened in his youth. And I wrote that story because I was living in Seattle. My family was in Minnesota or wherever they might have been. And I needed an emotional connection to my family. So as I'm writing this, I pulled characters from my life history. I based two of the characters on my mother and father, and I based another character on an attorney that I knew, and I based one of the people on a policeman that I knew the story of. And so that's how it began. But I did not consider that I was going into a series, and I didn't write my second book until 2017. So we go from 1989 to 2017. That's a big span. And then I've been about 1 a year since then.
And number 10 is about ready to come out. Nine have been written, and these are all, it can be read separately, right? You recommend you do them in sequence, but they can be read separately.
I get the question a lot because people want to know, will I miss something if I read your
Yes.
newest story? And the answer is, of course you will, but you can't start at the beginning of Baldacci or any of the people whose works are so famous that the next book he just can't wait for that. I tell people the first novel, The Deadly Winter, really sets the story. It gives you the location and the historical thing, and my protagonist Tom Hall shows up there, and you can read that. But it's not my best written book. I was young at the craft. I didn't have anybody. I mean, I'm self-taught in this whole thing, and so I make a lot of mistakes even now. Well, 17 years later, I came to the second story, and I do refer to the first story, but novel number two stands alone. Number nine stands alone. But if you were to read from the beginning, The Deadly Winter, all the way through, never personal, you would pick up little tidbits about the various characters. Some characters disappear, and I reference that in a future book that, of course, so-and-so died 2 years ago, and then you would know that was in a previous story, and maybe you'd like to go back and find out why the guy died.
And the series is receiving excellent reviews. Number 10 about to come out. You can follow this by going to Norby's website, check Amazon. You'll see when new books appear there as well. Just click on the author's name and that information comes up. What's amazing as I'm going through your career, you're a master of engraving, jewelry design, sculpture, painting, novels. The first one, as you mentioned, in 2013. What's it like going from one to another? Is there any connection there? It seems like each one is pretty much a separate skill.
Well, they are, but it's like, if you're a chef and you've specialized in Spanish cuisine, and then you went to Italy, which is pretty similar, and you discovered a new collection of herbs and a new way of doing a piece of meat, you wouldn't think that that is totally different. It's just a new experience in there. And I have something of a short attention span. 2 to 3 years is my attention span. I need to break things down every once in a while. And I tell people that question, well, why did you leave that behind? And do you feel like you're in a whole new career? No, it's all part of the creative process, Rick. And it started when I was about 3 years old and was given my first drawing lesson. And so I just keep moving on through these things. I go back and draw. And I'm just now, as a matter of fact, this morning, doing some research to start a new sculpture series that I hope to have done by the end of the year. Now that I've finished my 10th novel and I've got the first proofreading done, now I can think of something else. And I haven't done a piece of sculpture in 3 years, but my goal is to have six pieces of sculpture in this by the end of the year. This is March. I think there's plenty of time for that. But it's an exciting path to be on, but it's not for everyone. If you need to know what you're going to do next Monday, and if you need to know that you're going to get a paycheck every other Friday, this is not the path you want to take.
Well, and you've said that making art is simple, making a living is difficult. Talk about that and survival, because an artist has to have a sense of survival, don't they, to make it through those periods when the money is not coming in. There's not a regular paycheck.
Well, I that's not something to brag about, of course, but I've lost my entire fortune at two times in my career. Sold everything I had, including the family antiques, so that I wouldn't have to get a job and put the art behind me. So I've been committed. My children understand it, understood it, even though they didn't always agree with that. But there's a need to do these things. And I think I just wandered off of your question. Remind me of the question and let me come back and give a better answer.
Well, you were answering that there in the downtimes when you don't have that check coming in and you've got a payment due on the 31st and it's the 28th and there's nothing out there and the anxiety that you go through. But it's part of being an artist, I guess, isn't it?
Well, it's there, and that's why I think that's why you see artists who are popular for a while, then they disappear because they've spent all of their money along the way. You know, artists aren't given credit at the bank in most cases.
Yep, yes.
So you learn to go on a cash in hand. And I was at an exhibit in Texas a number of years ago, and at that time, if I had $100 in my pocket, I thought I was rich. And a young guy came into my exhibit, and he said, "Oh, this is interesting. What do you do? How much money do you make?" And I said, and I couldn't answer. And he says, "You make $10,000 a year?" And I said, "God, no." He said, "Oh," and he left, because all he knew was that the money was important. And when he left, I thought, I'll bet all of your fortune is in your credit card. And when I come to the end of the day, that $100 in my pocket is mine, and I know how to spend it. But I have spent the last 50 years putting every dollar into my art. The art galleries, what came from money that would have been in an IRA or 501 or whatever that might have been. But yes, I've been down to where I had less than $100, but I knew that if I did what I was supposed to do, I was going to survive. And that's all I've ever asked, that I could survive. And I told my children in 1979, I think you may have read this, that in 1979, I said, "I don't expect to be rich and famous, but if I can spend my life earning my living as an artist, then I will have had a successful life." Geez, I can't think of any better way to put it.
No, that's a nice way to sum it up and where you've been. And boy, the time is going by quickly. A couple of things I want to mention here at the end. You mentioned galleries. You've owned them. You've exhibited in them. You've helped other people. And I get the impression you really enjoy what over 150 people you've helped with your galleries to expose their work, their art. That's important to you, isn't it? To work with young people that are trying to make it as an artist.
Yeah, you know, this past weekend, I went to an art exhibit at a hotel put on by a local artist club, and I told a woman who was standing there, I said, "You know, if I had $100,000 I didn't know what to do with, I would probably open another art gallery because it's exciting. There's a demand. If you know, it's probably like swimming across a lake and you get to the halfway point and you say, 'Can I make it across?' You have to say yes, and you have to keep doing it. You can't quit doing it. I mean, it's very addictive. I opened my first art gallery because I needed a better way to exhibit my work. Having my work in a gallery was the answer, and nobody that owned an art gallery would take the kind of work I was doing. So I opened that, I suppose about a dozen artists that I also represented, made me look good, helped their careers. And I did that 8 times. And that's where you said I represented about 150 artists in their career. You know, today, I don't have a gallery. I was in a single gallery for the last 17 years, but I have concentrated on creating my art and teaching workshops. I teach writing and painting and sculpture workshops. I just had a 3-week session I finished last Tuesday. I got another thing going in April. But being an artist, and this might be the definitive statement, right, that I used to say, and I had to be careful, that being an artist is like being a farmer. It's a much smaller scale, but the farmer puts 100% into his job. Artist puts 100% into his job. Each one plants their seeds in a spring. They fertilize them, they maintain them, and they nurture them. And then they harvest that crop and hope somebody will buy it at a price that will allow them to do it again the following year. It is not a job. It's a lifestyle, and it's a hell of a route to go, and I'm happy to be on it.
Well, and you've done so well and continue to do well. If you go to Norbury's website, what will we find there? I mentioned the fact that you'll see your work there. You'll see how to contact you, because you were still doing what, commission work and doing paintings and sculpture. You mentioned you're just going to start sculpting. You just finished a book. What all will we find at the website, norbygallery.com?
Well, norbygallery.com is a collection of, you know, a lot of paintings and sculpture I've done. You're just Googling Arthur Norby, you get more information than you ever want to know. But my approach, or our approach, my wife Catherine, who handled all of the computer work, we're very personal and hands-on, and there's nothing pretentious about where we see ourselves in the world. So you get a chance to see paintings that might be 30 years old. You see sculptures that are, you know, 10 years or 50 years old, or brand new pieces of art. And that's at the norbygallery.com. And I would want to add in there that because I'm making an effort to be visible as an author, I have a new website called norbygallery.net that has only my books, and we'll be posting this video on both of those, by the way. I'm just available in a lot of places. I'm not afraid to give up my phone number and all of this stuff, but go to my website and you'll find that. But I will say that, you know, you can email me at norbygallery@gmail.com. And I always enjoy that interaction I get from people. On Facebook, I post a little 3-minute or 5-minute or 10-minute video every once in a while. And last summer I had a big event in Minnesota that took us a year to put together. And I did a combination of about 3 hours worth of videos promoting that event, which was 2 hours long on a Saturday. But just Google my name and you'll find out where I am.
Still going strong. Arthur Norby, our guest on the program. The website's, again, norbygallery.com and norbygallery.net. So you can do one or both, then you'll get information there. Links on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. The books are available, of course, at Amazon, the usual places. The Tom Hall Mystery Series, 9 available. Number 10 coming up very soon. And you'll have access to that at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of those places. And the one book you have is a coffee table book. Talk about this, because this is really sort of a piece of artwork for the coffee table.
Well, I think you're talking about Journey,
yes,
the Art of Arthur Norby. And we published that in 2005. And it was very professional business like reason for that. In the early 2000s, I was in the middle of a pretty successful career. And I had, you know, major commissions all over the country. And I wanted a reference for people that collected my work or might like to look back and see, you know, what had been done. So we my wife and I put our money together, and we self-published that book. It's called Journey, and it has everything from little whimsical sculptures to the monumental Minnesota Korean War Memorial. But what's reasonable about that, Rick, is that everyone cannot get to all of these cities to see the public art that artists have done. You know, there are tens of thousands of people just like me. And so a coffee table book like this, you put it on your table, and when your friends and family come to visit, you can say, I haven't gotten to see that piece of art, but I'd sure like to go. And as artists, we want that, you know, that that kind of reference, having the actual piece of art, the actual book, is our form of immortality. At the end of our lives, that's what we leave behind. And so the coffee table book, I think it's pretty decent. We spent a lot of money. Actually, it was not correct. My collectors spent a lot of money. I made them an offer they couldn't refuse, and my collectors paid a lot of money to have that published. It is only available from me, although you might find a used copy on Amazon.
Interesting. All of this, and again, I'll give you the websites, norbygallery.com, norbygallery.net. Norby is Norby. Books available at Amazon, the usual places. A link on our website will take you directly to his Amazon page as well as to his gallery page, and get all of the information there. Arthur, this has been a pleasure. What a career you've had. Continue to have. Hopefully we can do this again. Continued success. Thank you so much for spending time with us on the program today.
I appreciate having the opportunity, and I hope that your viewers will get a little entertainment out of this and continue to watch you. Thanks.
Thank you. It's been an enjoyable conversation with Arthur Norby, and be sure to check us out on YouTube. You go to YouTube, you'll be able to find us there, TWIATV. While there, like, hopefully a positive comment, and subscribe for future conversations. This Week in America, also on 28 podcast platforms. And my thanks to King Pages Press, the author's marketing consultant, results-oriented, making sure your work gets the attention it truly deserves.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.